Okay, so we are in Perek Yud, chapter 10. We are on page 1863, if you're using the stone Tanakh. And I need to make sure, I need to make sure that I'm out promptly at the end. I'm going to Olivia, so I will not be able to stay around at the end. So we are in Perek Yud, chapter 10, and we started the pact, we started the pact several weeks ago, but this pact, this new constitution that the Jews make, the contents of it begin in chapter 10, sentence 30, and we addressed the main opening question last week, which helps us understand what's in this constitution, the question of why do I need everything after the first sentence. The first sentence of their commitment says, we're going to follow the Torah and its laws. Why do you need to say anything after that? And we had three approaches. The first approach was that the opening sentence about Torah and mitzvot is a general statement, and the specifics are what's coming. So these are all, within this pact, they're all obligatory mitzvot. They're all commandments one must observe. That's the first approach. Second approach was the Zakheim idea that these are all rules that are needed to create the society we want. And that's why they're added. It isn't enough to say we're going to commit to Torah, but this is the way we're going to build the society we want. So we're going to have the donations to the temple, and we're going to be careful about Shabbat, and so on. The third approach, from Malbim and others, says that's not what's going on. Rather, everything after the opening line of this constitution is rabbinic legislation. Things which are added that the people are committing themselves to follow, except for the one that's about the intermarriage that the commentators seem to universally say is not a rabbinic rule. It's not about distinguishing between the seven Canaanite tribes and others. That they don't take that way, but everything else after that, various commentators interpret as being rabbinic. So, in chapter 10, sentence 32, which was still at the bottom of 1861, we were told about not buying merchandise on Shabbat from the non-Jews who are bringing it for people to buy. And Malbim said, that's because commerce on Shabbat is fundamentally rabbinically prohibited lest you violate biblical law. It's not explicit in the Torah. There are commercial interests that are forbidden from Yeshaya. You won't find the biblical verse saying, don't engage in commerce on Shabbat. So it's rabbinic legislation as explained by Malbim. The next one, it was also in sentence 32, was to observe Shemitah of land and money. Right? Shemitah of land, that in the seventh year you let the land go, and Shemitah of money, in the sense that in the seventh year, any debts that are outstanding are forgiven. Now here I got stuck last time. Right? Remember this? Because I thought Malbim believed that these were all rabbinic. And I kept reading what he was saying as we were there in the class, and it sounded like he was saying that it was biblical. But I went back and worked on it. I think what he actually is saying is that they were indeed taking something new here. He says, the rule of Shemitah Kesafim, of forgiving the debt, is not explicit in the Chumash. And then the part where he starts with the word v'nitosh, we will abandon, what he's saying is, he makes the comment there that there is a view that says that there is no such thing as Shemitah without Yovel. What he means is, even rabbinically, that there's a view that says there's no Shemitah even rabbinically when there's no Jubilee year, and what they were doing here was they were saying, rabbinically, we will follow Shemitah without Yovel. I think that's the way to read Malbim. But the bottom line is that his view is that that is a rabbinic line. Then we read sentences 33 to 35, which were all about support for the Beit HaMikdash, support for the temple, assigning families to bring the wood to be used on the altar, assigning families who would supply the karbanot, the offerings to be brought for the communal offerings that would be brought, giving the one-third shekel every year, which again is either the biblical rule of the half shekel, the coins have changed, or is a rabbinic addition to it. So all of that is what we saw last time. And it brings us to chapter 10, sentence 36, which is where we venture forward in this constitution of theirs. So take a look, please, at sentences 36 and 37. Ulahavi, We also agreed that we would bring, as Bikurei Admasenu, the first fruits of our land, Ubikurei Kol Pri Chol Eitz Shana Vishana, and to bring the first of all produce, all trees, year after year, Lebeis Hashem, to the house of God. So we're going to bring the first fruit of our land, the first fruit of our trees, the first of all produce, to the house of God. Ves bechoros banenu uvehemtenu, as well as the firstborn of our sons and the firstborn of our animals, kakasufa Torah, as is written in the Torah. Ves bechore vikarenu vitsonenu, and the firstborn of our cattle, our sheep, lahavila beis elokenu, to bring to the house of our God. La koanim hamishar sim beis elokenu, for the koanim who serve in the house of our God. What are the problems in these two sentences we just read? 36 and 37. What's wrong here?
Well, the beasts are slaughtered. You don't slaughter the first son. Yeah.
Right, that's the hope, yes.
Well, yeah. Well, but if you just read it as such.
Makes it sound like it, no? It
looks like you.
Right, except.
You can just slaughter and.
Yeah. They look, you know, sometimes it's just rough. They, what is the mitzvah that we have with the firstborn in the temple? Firstborn kids? Right? Redeem it. You give the money to the Kohen.
Yeah.
And so that presumably is what they're referring to here. Rebecca, what were you going to say?
But it says, it says bring all of them, and yet it tends only to bring the
thanks. So yeah, it says all fruit here, but as we're going to see, traditionally we are taught, yeah, we can see it right now. Take a look at the first source on your sheet. It's a Mishnah in Bikurim. Ein mevin Bikurim chutz mishivat aminim. The Bikurim are specifically the first of the seven species for which Israel is known, as explained in the Torah in Devarim, somewhere around chapter 7, 8, 9, maybe 7, in which we are told about wheat, barley, right? You remember the list? Eretz Chital, Sa'ora, the Gefen, Teina, Rimon, Zeit Shemen, and Dvash. Grapes, figs, pomegranates, olives, and dates. That's your list. So what do you mean when you emphasize here the first of Kol Pri, all produce? That's one question. What else is strange here?
Leviam
never got those.
Oh, never got
no,
Leviam.
None of those. All of those things are Kohen food, so to speak. But if you look at sentence 37, right? What exactly, besides the sons, right? What exactly are you bringing there? Firstborn of what? No. First you said behemtenu, our animals. Then you said bikarenu vitsoninu, our cattle and sheep. So what were our animals?
So we had turnip animals, but those weren't animals we tended to bring to the temple.
Yeah. What is this? I don't follow what this is. Sheep is a good question, but sheep I would think would be under tzon, right? That's what tzon is.
Yeah. JPS doesn't translate that.
What does JPS do?
It says cattle and flocks.
Cattle and flocks. Like what I have, oh, not what I have planted in the backyard.
P-H-L-O-X.
So, flocks of what?
Well, a flock refers to something that's avian, right?
Oh, no. When tzon fly. No, tzon don't fly. Tzon is always going to be a reference to sheep. I don't know why they're using the term, I don't know why they're using that term, but tzon is sheep.
Flocks of
sheep.
Yeah. No, there's a source here. I have to look up.
Okay. So we're going to get to sources. That's okay.
Okay.
That will take care of it. So we don't understand the language here in terms of the animals, and we don't understand which fruit we're talking about. So the question then is, you know, what is this? And now let's make it even worse. We said, and we recapped it in the beginning of the class, you know, a while ago, we said that we have two different main views about the nature of these things the Jews are accepting. Either this is reinforcement of biblical law, or these are rabbinic legislation. But it says explicitly, kakasuv batorah, as recorded in the Torah. That doesn't sound like rabbinic legislation to me. How can the view that these are rabbinic make heads or tails of the fact that the verse says explicitly we're committing to do as is written in the Torah. So let's deal with the first fruits first, and then we'll deal with the first animal second. The bikurim of the ground tree all fruit. So the core mitzvah found in the Torah is, as Rebecca notes, the seven species. Technically, if you go back to the biblical verses that give us the mitzvah of Bikurim, which are in Shmot chapter 23 and in Devarim chapter 26, it doesn't actually say which species you bring. Bikurei Admatcha, the first fruit produced by your land. That's all it actually says. However, when the Torah talks about this mitzvah, at one point the Torah says, Mei Reishit, V'lakachta, you shall take Mei Reishit, Kopri Adama, from the first. So from the first, the sages understood means not all of your stuff, but rather certain species, which are the ones that Israel is known for. And that's how you get this idea, which we saw in source number one. However, it is worth noting, and I gave you the reference in Yechezkel and Ezekiel, we're not going to look it up inside right now, but if you want to take a look at some point, you may, that Yechezkel speaks about the mitzvah of bringing bikurim, and he says, bikurei kol, the first of everything. So it's not, you know, it's not bizarre to see this here. But yes, our general understanding is that the core mitzvah is limited to the seven species. So if I take the view that this is simply biblical law, right, and nothing is being added here in this new constitution, but we're just following biblical law, what I'm going to do is what Ibn Ezra does. If you take a look at source number four, Ibn Ezra says, yeah, yes, it says all, but it doesn't mean all. Just like in Yechezkel. He says, Heman iskarim b'pasuk. It means the species mentioned in the text. Gefen, Teina, Rimon. It's talking about the grapes. It's talking about the figs. It's talking about the pomegranates. Ushari, Tzim, and the other trees. Veheim shiv'aminim. It means the seven species. The other trees there, I guess, is olives and grapes. Actually, no, he mentioned grapes. So it's olives and dates. Olives and dates. He mentioned pomegranate. V'chein amru chazal ein mevin bikurim ela mishivat haminim bilvad. So Ibn Ezra's answer is, don't get hung up on the word kol. Don't get hung up on saying everything. It isn't everything. It means the seven species. Move on. That's Ibn Ezra's take.
So everything of a predefined group.
Everything in the set that you're familiar with.
Defined previously. Okay.
Correct. That's his view. However, those who say that what's being brought in this pact, in this constitution, is specifically rabbinic legislation, they say, yeah, that's exactly the point. This is indeed an addition. Instead of doing what we were required to do, which is to say the seven species, we're going to now do everything. And so take a look at Rashi in source number two. That's exactly the point. He says, Bikurei shall kol pri ha'ilan. Right? First of every kind of tree fruit, hemidivrei chachamim. It was a rabbinic enactment that they observed at that point. That's Rashi's take. But this is a problem. And the reason it's a problem is because we have no such rabbinic law that we're familiar with. You can choose to bring and give to the Kohen and whatever you like, but it doesn't become bikurim. We don't have such an idea. So the Malbim takes it a little bit differently. He reminds you of that which is learned every morning when one says Birchat HaTorah. Right? There are blessings to be recited daily on Torah study. So traditionally, after reciting the blessings, we learn a little bit of Torah. One, you learn a text that is from Tanakh, right? Usually practice in our shuls is to do Birchat Kohanim, Yivracha, and so on. Other psukim have been used at other times. Classically, the first parak of Yehoshua, where they tell Yehoshua, Chazak ve'amatz, to be strong and courageous, that was actually used at one point as the text that people would say after Birkot HaTorah. But then after that, we learn something from Torah Sheba'al Peh, something from the spoken Torah. And what's learned usually is the first Mishnah in Peah, followed by a Tosefta, an added text, in which we talk about Dvarim She'elahem Shi'ur, certain mitzvot which have no Shi'ur. Shi'ur can mean either a minimum amount or a maximum amount, depending on the mitzvah you're talking about. But one of the items listed there is the Bikurim. And what we're saying is, there is no minimum for the Bikurim. You bring one thing, you fulfilled the mitzvah. You brought one grape, you did the mitzvah. That's the rule. There's no shiur. There's no minimum for it. So take a look at source number 3, where the Malbim says that's what's going on here. He first quotes Rashi, and he says, "Vahu tamua." Rashi's view is surprising. "Dimavur b'Yerushalmi bikurim, dimehvi bikurim chutz mishivat haminim lo nisgad shu." The Yerushalmi says that if you bring species outside of the seven, they do not gain kedusha, they do not gain holiness. Vinirai, he says, it appears, v'pnei shemin haTorah ein shi'ur l'bikurim. He says, biblically, there is no shi'ur, there is no minimum threshold for you to bring for the bikurim. Kiblu aleihem lahavila beis Hashem matana re'uya. So they said, you know what, we're going to bring a proper gift. Echad mishishim, 1/60th of whatever grows, kitachana chachamim, which is in fact the rabbinic enactment. So this is the school of thought that says their new constitution is rabbinic legislation, is that they said, we're instituting a minimum. Clear? Okay. Then we get to the other piece of this, which is the firstborn of the animals, as well as the sheep and cattle, who apparently are not animals. So what does that mean? So again, remember, Ibn Ezra thinks these laws are biblical. See, Ibn Ezra says, the answer is, did I bring it on the sheet? No, I did not. Ibn Ezra says that when it says behema, it means the non-kosher animals. Because if you were to look at the end of Parshas Bo, that's what you have there, Susan?
Yeah.
I wrote Malvin? Oh, huh, that's funny. No, that's a mistake.
They have to, like,
okay.
For a lamb. Oh, number 5.
Yeah,
number 5 you said is
Malvin. Yeah, no, that's even Ezra. Sorry.
Okay.
No, you know what? I'm sorry. Hang on. Hold on. Hold on. No, it is Malvin, but you'll see why. Just hang in there. You right? But yes, Ibn Ezra says non-kosher animals, meaning the donkey. At the end of Parshas Bo, we're told about the mitzvah of Peter Chamor, right? You may remember last year there was a Sephardi shul that did a fundraiser with a Peter Chamor, and everybody came together to see them exchange a sheep for a donkey. So that's from the end of Parshas Bo. It's Shmot, Perikud Gimel, chapter 13 in Exodus, in Shmos. And that's what it's referring to here, is redeeming the firstborn donkey. So it's a biblical law. And that's the idea, according to Ibn Ezra, which is fitting Rabbi Eliezer in the Gemara and the Yerushalmi, which we're going to see. However, Malbim says no. He agrees with the idea that it's the non-kosher animal, but he says it's rabbinic. How? So that's what I brought you in number 5. He says, Ubehem tenu, and our animals, hainu behema tmeya, that's the non-kosher animals, meaning specifically, she'ein tzorech lahavil hapidyon lebeis Hashem. He says what they're adding is that we're going to bring it to the house of God. Because the rule is, when you redeem the donkey, you don't have to bring it to the temple, you give the sheep to the Kohen as a gift. Or you give the value of the sheep to the Kohen as a gift. Or you can kill the donkey. But there's no need to bring something to the temple at all. So what they're instituting rabbinically here is, we're going to bring this and do this at the site of the temple. And then in terms of the firstborn of the domestic animals, the sheep and the cattle, which we do, again, have biblically, he says, "Bikurei b'kareinu avila beit elokeinu," that's l'hakrava, that's to sacrifice the firstborn. Meaning, you have two options with your firstborn cattle, right? One option is you bring it to the temple as a carbon. The other option is you wait for it to get a blemish, and then you redeem it, right? It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be brought as a carbon. I mean, there's more to say about that, but basically, what he's suggesting is there is still a rabbinic aspect to what they are doing here, both in terms of the bikurim and in terms of the firstborn animals. There? Gita, you're going to say?
No.
Okay. So that brings us to the last part, which is sentences 38 to 40. Lamed Chet Tamem. Again, it's page 1863 in the Stone Tanakh. Ve'ez reishis arisoseinu, usrumoseinu, ufri chol eitz tirosh v'yitzhar. The first of our arisa, this is talking about your first dough, what we call... challah. Right, challah. The Torah describes the mitzvah of separating challah from your dough. Right, the word challah does not mean the bread we eat on Shabbos and Yom Tov. It doesn't mean folk egg bread that Jews picked up at some point. The meaning of challah is the tithe that you separate any time you make bread. If you make a certain quantity, you have to separate it and give it to the Kohen. The Torah says, "Rishis avisoseichem," the first of your dough. So the first of our dough, usrumoseinu, and our truma tithes, which is supposed to be a percentage of your produce that goes to the Kohanim, ufri chol eitz tirosh v'yitzhar, and the fruit of every tree, as well as tirosh v'yitzhar. Tirosh is wine, and yitzhar is oil, and it means the truma from those things. Navila Kohanim, we're going to bring it to the Kohanim, el lishchos beis elokeinu, to the offices of the house of our God. Umasarad maseinu, and the tithe from our produce, la leviim, right? One tenth goes to the Levi. Veheim haleviim ma'asrim b'chol arei avodaseinu, and these are the leviim who separate the tithes in all of the cities of our labor. Meaning, the leviim are the ones who take the tithes right now in all of our cities.
The tax collectors.
Well, except that it's for themselves.
Oh, yeah.
They are tax collectors.
Yes. Collect
this is what we call tax and spend. The one-stop shopping. So we're now going to say the truma is all going to the temple, right? The maaser is going to the Leviim who collect the tithes in all of our cities. But then look what happens in the next sentence. V'hayah kohen ben Aharon im haleviim ba'aser haleviim. The Kohen, descendant of Aaron, is going to be with the Leviim when the Leviim get the tithe. V'Leviim ya'aluas ma'asar ha-ma'aser leveis elokeinu el l'shachos leveis ha'utsar. The Leviim have a mitzvah called Trumas Ma'aser. Trumas Ma'aser is that one-tenth of the tithe that you receive has to be kicked back to the Kohen. Kicked back is an unfortunate turn of phrase. Has to be given back to the Kohen. So, in other words, I'm the farmer. I have to take a percentage of my produce and give it to the Kohen as truma. That percentage is not fixed. It's somewhere around 2%. You're allowed to be a little stingier. You're allowed to be a little bit more benevolent, but it's around 2%. So I give that to the Kohen. I take 10% and I give it to the Levi. The Levi turns around and takes 10% of what he received and gives that to the Kohen. That's called trumas maser or trumat maser. So now the Kohen is going to lurk with the Leviim. When the Leviim get their tithe, and the Leviim are going to give the Trumat Maaser to the houses of God, to the stores in the temple. One final sentence. Kiel ha-leshachos yaviu b'nei Yisrael, because the Jews are going to bring everything to those offices. Uvnei ha-levi, es trumas ha-dagana tirosh v'yitzhar, v'sham klei ha-mikdash, v'akohanim ha-mishrasim ha-sharim ha-mishorim. As well as the Leviim. They're going to bring the truma, the tithe from the grain, the tithe from the wine, the tithe from the oil. That's where you have the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. That's where you have the Kohanim who serve. That's where you have the Leviim who are the gatekeepers and the singers. Velo nazov es beis elokeinu, and we will not abandon the house of our God. What is strange in these last three sentences?
One of the things is this Kohen who's with the Levi.
Yeah. Why is the Kohen hanging out with the Levi? He can't wait to get his hands on that one-tenth of one-tenth. Right? These are the one percenters. He can't wait to get that. Yeah.
Are these people sitting, or are they going out to get it? Am I wrong? It seems like they're going out to get it.
So at first it sounded like they were going out to get it, and then it sounds like we're making this, you know, we're relocating the process.
Right.
Exactly. So there are a few things that are strange here. One is the presence of the Kohen with the Levi. Another thing is, what is this insistence on doing it all at the site of the temple? And then another question, these are biblical laws. Mm-hmm. If you're within the Malbim's camp, that we're doing something rabbinic, what's rabbinic about Truma and Maaser? So we need to address all three of these questions. So first of all, in terms of the rabbinic versus the biblical, the Rambam's view is that all of this is rabbinic in their day. Once you hit the Second Temple period, it's all rabbinic because the Jews have not returned to the land in such numbers and representation from the different Shvatim, from the different tribes, such that it would become biblical. We talked about this. We talked about Kedusha Rishona, the first sanctity, and what happened to it. So the view of the Rambam of Maimonides is that it's all rabbinic. In fact, that's a view in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud. Take a look at source number 7. This is the position of Rabbi Elazar. It's a debate between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina we saw last week. He was the one who said that actually it is all biblical. And he said when the text says that they accepted all of these things, it means that they decided they would do it with joy as though they were accepting it voluntarily. But Rabbi Elazar's view is no, it really is voluntary. Number 7, Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar said, Me'elehen kiblu alehen et ha'ma'asrot. He says they accepted the obligation to tithe on their own. Matam, what's your basis for it? And he quotes, chapter 10, sentence 1, V'chalzot anu kortim amana v'kotim and so on. We made a pact and we decided that this is what we were going to do. So he says, Rabbi Elazar says, the whole thing is rabbinic, and that's brought in various sources. That's not the only way to take it, though. Rebecca, you're going to say? No? Okay. Another approach is the approach of the Ravid. The Ravid disagrees with the Rambam on the idea that the sanctity today is rabbinic, but he says that here it looks like they are tithing more than just the biblical triad. The biblical triad is Dagan Tirosh V'Yitzhar, grain, wine, and oil. And after all, it said in sentence 38, pre-kol eitz, the fruit of every tree. So he takes that to mean that they're bringing what we do as our practice for Truon Maaser, not just the biblical, but they're expanding to other types of produce. And Malbim brings both of these explanations. Take a look, please, at source number 8. Number 6, I should say, sorry. He says, Hu nachon me'od l'das ha-Rambam. He says, this fits well with the Rambam's view, to be most Ezra, lo ha-yuchayvim b'chalo truma maser, that in Ezra's day, there was no obligation to separate chalo truma maser biblically. And then he says, l'das ha-Ravid, within Ravid's view, shat truma hi min ha-Torah v'rak chala d'Rabbanan. He says, truma is biblical in their day, although chala is rabbinic. Yesh lomar shekibu aleim truma sh'ar peros. You could say they accepted other types of produce. Yeah, I went backwards in the source sheet. I flipped 6 and 7 for some reason. Don't ask me why, because I don't know. That's their way to look at it. So you have, again, either it could be rabbinic, it could be biblical. And again, Ibn Ezra says, no, of course it's biblical. Okay. So
it's kind of lotus seed. Like, how can you just take a species that you were told to do this species and you say, no, we're going to be better. We're going to do all species.
Right. So this is a classic and very important question. On the one hand, the Chumash is very specific and very clear. Lo sosef alav, velo sigri umimenu. Do not add to the Torah, do not subtract from the Torah. At the same time, the Chumash explicitly empowers the rabbis to make decisions and to create enactments. So the answer has to be that you have a procedure for amendment, so to speak, and you can follow that procedure. And if you don't follow that procedure, you're guilty of adding or subtracting. But there is a mechanism by which they can add, and this is what we're actually witnessing live, like the point that Susan made last week, right? This is a live example of rabbinic enactment that we get to observe here. Not the only one, but it's certainly rare to see it with this kind of detail. The nation, the day before this, in the previous chapter, did not have an obligation, and now suddenly they do. That
but
this
they
is what
they have to recognize that it's rabbinic.
Yes.
They do not think that it's right.
And that's something that's very important that the Rambam takes pains to do. Is to highlight where something is biblical, something is rabbinic. In the laws of Shabbos, that becomes very relevant. But yes. So now I understand what's biblical here or what could be rabbinic. But why is the Kohen hanging out with the Levium? So this is the basis for something that we learned last year. And at the time that we learned it, we asked, where in the world did that come from? It's a Gemara in Yevamos, which says that originally the Levium were supposed to get the tithes, the 10%. However, remember that when Ezra made his Aliyah, he couldn't find Levium, and he had to send somebody to go looking for Levium, and finally they scrounged and they found some Levium. And we said then, the Gemara says, that at that point, Ezra made a decree punishing the Levim, saying, you lose your Meiser. And then either the Meiser goes to the Kohanim, or it goes to the needy, but it doesn't stick with Levim, so much so that that's halacha now today. Meaning, if I have Israeli produce, I separate 2%, and that's theoretically for the Kohen. It's not actually for the Kohen because of impurity nowadays, so I'm just going to let it rot and then throw it out. I can't give it to the Kohen. And then I separate off another bit, which is not Maaser, but is 1/10 of the Maaser. It's the 1% that should have gone to the Kohen. But the rest of Maaser, I'm going to eat myself. I am neither Kohen nor Levi, but I have no duty to give it to the Levi, because Levium lost it. But we said at the time, I don't understand. What do you mean? Where does it say? The text never said that Ezra made such a decree. We couldn't find any source. So where did it come from? This is where it comes from. When the Kohanim are mentioned as hanging out with the Levium to take the Meiser, so take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 9. Gemara Yevamos. Mibnei ma kansu Levium b'maaser. Why did they find the Levium to lose the Meiser? Pligi ba Rabbi Yonatan v'Savaya. Rabbi Yonatan and the elders had a debate. Chad amar shelo alu b'mei Ezra. One said because Ezra couldn't get them to come with him. V'chad amar, and the other one said, k'dei sheyismichu kohanim alav b'mei tumasan. It wasn't to harm the Levium or to punish the Levium. It was to support the Kohanim. Because when a Kohen is impure, the Kohen is not able to eat truma. So they need something else. Meiser doesn't have the same requirements. They can eat Meiser. So the Gemara says, wait. Bishlam alaman da'amar shalo alu. I get it. The English continues on the other side. I get it if you're going to say that it's a punishment for the Levium for not going with Ezra. Mishim hachi kansinu. So fine, the Levium, you know, get punished. That happens in life. El man da'amar k'deshe yismichu alav kohanim v'mei tumasan. But if it's because you want to support the kohanim, mishum kohanim kansinu Levium. So Levium have to suffer because the kohanim need to eat? Take from somebody else. Institute a new tax. Ella kule alma kanasa shlo alu b'mei Ezra. You're right. Everybody within this discussion agrees that fundamentally it's a penalty to the Levium for not going. Bahacha bahakim iplagi. This is the debate. The debate is, where does it go when it's taken from the Levium? Mar sabar knasa la'aniyim. One said that the fine was given to the needy. Umar sabar kohanim b'mei tumasan aniyim ninu. And the other one said, no, the kohanim use it when they are impure, because at that point they are in fact needy. So we read that Gemara at the time, and we asked, but where did they get this idea from? And the answer is from here. From the statement that the Levium are going to be accompanied and escorted by Kohanim, who are also going to have the right to be able to take it. The Levium don't lose the right to get it, but it doesn't have to go to them, per se, anymore. That's the basis. And Tosfo says so. Tosfo was writing in the 13th century, offers us our verse as the basis for it. Take a look at source number 10. They want to know, where in the world did he get it from? So, Baharav Rabbeinu Yosef Omer, Rabbi Yosef, one of the authors of the Tosfot commentary, says, "Dinafgalan mi dichsiv b'malachi." He draws it from a pasuk in Malachi. Remember the Medrash about Malachi being Ezra. Malachi instructs the Jews, bring all of your tithes to the granary. The base haotzar, really the storehouse. The base haotzar who lishkasha tikein Ezra la seisham trumas kohanim kedichsiv be'Ezra. That's the room that Ezra enacted. Notice he says Ezra enacted. We haven't seen hide or hair of Ezra in this. Nonetheless, Ezra enacted that they should put this there kedichsiv be'Ezra, like the pasuk says in Ezra, meaning Nehemiah 10. The kevan shemitzava la seis sham maaser. And if he told them put the maaser in that storehouse, in the Beis HaMikdash, in Kench HaKohanim, it must be that it belongs to the Kohanim. But Kamalan Malachi Ze Ezra, and we have this tradition that Ezra and Malachi are one and the same for reasons we've discussed on other occasions. But the point here is that our text here is the basis for the idea. That it was taken away from the Levium, and now the Kohanim get it. And so Ralbag says that's why the Kohanim are present here. They're present because they're going to collect the tithes instead of the Levium. It used to go to the Levium, who collected in all of our cities. And now it's going to the Kohanim. Food. The Levim are going to eat whatever they get. I mean, keep in mind that the Levim have a latitude that the Kohanim don't necessarily have. First of all, they have numbers, which on the one hand means there are more of them to support, but on the other hand it means you have more who can actually work. But in the Arei HaLevim, in the cities that are dedicated to the Levim, they have opportunities to engage in business there. That's their land. The Kohanim seem to be much more dedicated. Aside from their time working in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, they in general are dedicated to teaching, judging, and being available for the nation. So it's a lot harder for them. I guess that's why they need the greater support. Plus the fact that, as noted here, they have periods of impurity and then the Truma is not available to them. So that's that. That's that point. That's why they're there. But the last point is to me the most important, in a sense, in this section, which is this business of we will not abandon the house of God. They make a statement. From now on, this is all going to be done at headquarters. Why is it being done at headquarters? Why do you do it in the Beis HaMikdash?
Control.
Supervision. Centralizes it. All valid points. But it's very interesting. The approach that I've seen in at least some of the commentators is to go the other route. It has to do with the Kohanim. It's not about making sure the people are doing it. It's about making sure the Kohanim are doing their job. So take a look at source number 11. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler. He says, Ve'akohanim, and the Kohanim, as seen here, Yeshvusham l'shomram. They sit there to guard them, to guard the vessels of the temple. L'zeyavil l'sham es ha'truma. So you bring the truma there, because that way, the Kohanim are there to guard the vessels of the temple. So make sure you bring the tithes that they're supposed to get over to that spot. And Professor Zer Kavod in Dan Mikra takes this a step further. We're afraid that they're going to leave their posts to go get Truma. So the servants of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, don't leave their duties. They will be certain that they're going to get their portions. Because we're going to find out in chapter 13, Nehemiah is going to go back home. He is home. He's going to go back to Persia. And he's going to return then at some point to Judea. And he's going to find that which he had enacted has sort of fallen by the wayside in his absence. And one of the issues is that the Kohanim are not doing their jobs. So that's what they're trying to avoid here. And they're saying, if the Kohanim need to be there in order to get lunch, then they're going to actually do their jobs. So it's not about control of the nation as much as it's control of the Kohanim. That's the idea. Okay. But it is very interesting that the Gemara thinks that this is Ezra who makes this or Tosos thinks that it's Ezra who makes the enactment, not Nehemiah. When we haven't seen him. You know, maybe a hint in Sariah who signs on the pact. That was about it. Okay. So that's chapter 10. The Jews now have a new constitution. But we've been waiting since chapter 7 to take care of business. Right? What was the business that we were supposed to do back in chapter 7?
Jerusalem.
Yeah. Remember, the city is empty. How are you going to defend it? You don't have enough people. You won't tell when there's an invasion. So, we just dropped that, right? We dropped it because, if you recall, we dropped it because we started talking about the census that they took. Right? In chapter 7, we said we need to populate Jerusalem. He had set up the rules for the wall administration. And then we said we need to populate it. So they did a census, but they brought the census in from Ezra chapter 2. Then we had this public Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah, which either came about now while they were about to work on repopulating Jerusalem, or was actually being ported in. It had occurred at an earlier time, back when they did the census originally. Then we had the people with their national tshuva, their national repentance, which again, it either occurred earlier or is happening now. And then you have this national constitution. And someone says, oh, you know, weren't we about to do something? Yeah, we were going to repopulate Jerusalem. So let's do that. And that's what we're going to do at this point. Now, I am going to spare you some pain in this regard. I'm really sparing myself, to be honest. But take a fast look at Divrei Yamim 1, Chronicles 1, chapter 9. It's on page 1895. Yep. Yep. Chronicles 1, chapter 9. Okay? You'll get the opening sentences of it. And all Israel set up their lineage. It's recorded in the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, right? That whole business. The first ones who settled in their portions, in their cities, Yisrael, Cohen, and Levi, and Netinim, and in Jerusalem dwelt from Yehuda, Binyamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, and then you get a whole bunch of names. Now, while looking at that, take a look at Nehemiah chapter 11. Specifically starting in sentence 3. Chapter 11, sentence 3. And these are the heads of the nation who dwelled in Jerusalem and in the cities of Judah. They sat, the Israel, Kohanim, Levi'im, Netinim. We add in Abdei Shlomo. And then in Jerusalem they dwelled, and you get a whole bunch of names. What you would see if you were to devote time to this is that you have a list of people who dwell in Jerusalem and in the other cities in Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 9. And you have a parallel list in Nehemiah chapter 11. And the lists are, for the large parts, the same, but with significant variations. So there are commentators who actually will go through the different changes and try to explain why it's one way and one and why it's the other way and the other. And that's what I meant when I said I'm sparing the collective us from going through this detail by detail. I only bring you on your sheet source number 14, where Malbim makes his observation, hey, this is interesting, these lists are different. Malbim writes, Da, you have to know, Shadvarim hamuzkarim po nimtzim gamkim v'divrei hayam aleph simin tes. What you see here is also found in divrei hayamim. V'sham nimtzim shinuyim rabim, and there are many differences there. V'yesh bein hanusach sham upo stirot rabot. There are many contradictions between the two texts. Shama farshim amru bam dvarim zarim, and commentators have said strange things to try to make them work. Ulam, however, harachasim kulam yehulam yishor. All of the ruts will ultimately be laid straight. They'll be flattened out, smoothed out. Alpi mashakatuv shesefer sheomar shesefer Ezra hu hashlamat sefer divrei hayamim. He says, refer back to what I told you in the beginning of the book of Ezra. Really, mashamarti mashakatavti, that Ezra is a completion of divrei hayamim. Remember, we talked about this ages and ages and ages ago. However many weeks back that was. Actually, I think I said it on the sheet. This is week 55, so you know. But what we said then is that there are different ways to look at the authorship of Divrei Hayamim and Ezra, but the Gemara believes they're both written by Ezra, and what Malbim says is that Ezra, the book of Ezra, is meant to complete Divrei Hayamim. Remember that the last sentence in Divrei Hayamim was the same as the opening of the book of Ezra, about how Koresh allows the Jews to come back, and he says, whoever wants to go, go up. And that's the way Ezra begins. He says, yeah, that Ezra is the completion of Divrei Hayamim. Ve'ezra sofer chiber sefer Ezra le'sefer Divrei Hayamim shekatav kodem lo. And Ezra joined the two together. V'Nehemiah hishlim sefer Ezra. And Nehemiah comes along and he completes the book of Ezra. She'ezra kotev sefer Divrei Hayamim chazar hadvim shne'amru b'sfarim hakodmim lefareisha lo'osif bahem eidah devar shelo nizkar sham. He says when Ezra writes Divrei Hayamim and then he writes these other things, he goes back over that which was mentioned in earlier books, but he wants to explain or wants to add something new. V'chein Nehemiah, and so too with Nehemiah, k'shechazar po advarim shekvar katav Ezra b'divrei hayamim, when Nehemiah reviews things that Ezra already wrote about in Divrei Hayamim, lo bala ha'atik dvarim ha'kodmim. He's not simply going to copy what was there before. Ra katav ha'safot ala kodim mashla nizkar sham. He added things that weren't there before. So in other words, Nehemiah is meant, the list of Nehemiah is meant as an addendum to the list that's in Divrei Hayamim. Ezra recorded in Divrei Hayamim the list of who was dwelling in Jerusalem. However, there were things that were left out. What Malbim does not address is why were some things left out. Why is this name not here? Why is that family suddenly, omitted? And we can go back over the explanations we've given in lists before. Some people moved, they moved in, they weren't important at that time. All sorts of different explanations you can give. But the bottom line is that as far as Malbim is concerned, you should view the list here as simply something that is completing the list that was started in Chronicles.
There's no repetition?
Right, so there is repetition, and that's the part that I didn't bring you in this Malbim. He goes through some of the repetition parts and tries to show you why those are needed. It was a decision of where the headache will be worse, you know? And my thought was the headache will be worse if we try to go through it as opposed to if we just say, okay, that was nice. Okay, so the opening part of chapter 11 is going to be the lottery, the decision of who's supposed to live. Every time I think the lottery, I think of Shirley Jackson. So the opening part is going to be the lottery to get 10% to live in Jerusalem. Then we get a list of who lives in Jerusalem, and then we get a list of who lived elsewhere. But it's not that simple. It's not really that straightforward. As we'll see, it's a little complicated in terms of the question of what time period we are describing when we say this is who lived in Jerusalem. But we'll come to that. That's next week's issue. What I want to talk about for this week is just the opening two sentences of the chapter. If we can get through that, we will have done a lot. So chapter 11, sentence 1. It's page 1863. Vayeshevu Sarei Ha'am Birushalayim. The leaders of the nation, the nobility, dwelled in Jerusalem. Ushar Ha'am Hipilu Garalot. And the rest of the nation cast lots. Lavi Echad Min Ha'asara. To bring one out of every 10. Lashevet Birushalayim Ir HaKodesh. To dwell in Jerusalem, the sacred city. Vesesha Hayados Be'arim. And the other 90%, the other 9 out of 10, are going to dwell in the cities. And the nation blessed all those who volunteered to dwell in Jerusalem. Clear?
Didn't volunteer.
Yeah,
they won the lottery.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem. This is what we call a volunteer. Thank you for volunteering. Okay? That's one question. I have a different question. Why 10%? Why 10%? I mean, do you need 10% of your population in your capital? Is that like a magic number?
They know what the base is, and they know that 10% will equal the number that they need to settle.
I mean, so it's just a pragmatic decision based on...
We have 100 people here.
It's Maaser.
Right, we like 10%.
It's Maaser.
Right, it's Maaser. That's another way to look at it. I think those are two important approaches. One approach is what Debbie said. It's a practical thing. We needed 10%. Nehemiah, right, the big master planner, looks at the city and says, 10% of the population will do. The other idea that Keitha puts forth is that it's actually a religious act. Maaser is tithe. And just like you, or meiser, to use the colloquial. And just like when it comes to tzedakah, we're supposed to give a tenth, right? Set aside a tenth. And just like the part that used to go to the Levium until it was taken away from them and given to others, it was 10%. So something we hear, you know, the nation has to give 10%.
It's also a number that people who aren't numerical, can understand. It's a very not everybody can read and write.
Right. For this you just show up and they tell you where you're going.
Yeah, but 10% is a number that works any.
They didn't have a decimal. They probably didn't work on the decimal.
They had 10 fingers. I'm sure they did by then.
Yeah, I mean, they are working with a decimal system, meaning all their numbers get rounded off by and large. Not all, but many of the numbers get rounded off to the nearest 10.
And it's not really a 10, it's by family, is it not?
Well, so is it really 1 out of every 10 families?
Right.
Effectively, as opposed to 1 every 10 individuals? I would assume so, because otherwise you're going to split up families. So in terms of this 10, let's take the tithe issue first. I was reminded of a discussion I had with Rabbi Ziering going back a ways. And here I'll also mention, I think I put it in one of the emails, that the Beit Midrash has our June dinner, our annual dinner on June 27th. And among other things, we are going to be paying tribute to the Zierings, Rabbi and Ora Ziering, who are leaving, go back to Israel. That, for me, is a personal loss. Frankly, each loss of a Scan has been a personal loss. The Weintraubs were fantastic. Rabbi Berzan was fantastic. But it's certainly true that he has added a ton to our city. So for those who have benefited, it will be a good opportunity to show that gratitude to them. Sorry?
Not to, I don't want to disagree with you, but they have added. I know,
yes.
Add to what you said.
Yeah.
Or
absolutely. No, that's why I mentioned her before.
No, I don't know.
Because I don't work with her every day. I sit next to her, I see her every day. But no, that's why I mentioned her as well. Absolutely. She added tremendously. Okay. I can go on quite a bit about what Orah has done also. So, if you take a look at number 15, this was the result of a conversation that he and I had a while back about the choice of Levi as the Shevet, the tribe, that's going to do the work in the Mishkan and then ultimately the Beit HaMikdash. Why do we select the tribe of Levi specifically? So the classic answer is because they didn't serve the golden calf. Right? At the Egel, the golden calf, Moshe says, Mila Shem Elai, right? Who is for God? Join me, and lo and behold, the Levim are the ones who show up. So that's the conventional answer. However, there is a Medrash which says something else. Yaakov is on the run from his brother Esav. Yaakov makes a promise to God. He says, if you'll do this, you'll do this, you'll do this, right? The chol asher titein li, everything you give me, aser aserenu lach, I will separate a tenth for you. That's Yaakov's promise to God. So on this, take a look at source number 15. This is from Toronto Torah, back in Parshas Vayetze, Rabbi Ziering's Parsha article. Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, Parak Lamed Zayin, propounds that the tribe of Levi's eventual status as the officers of the Mikdash was decided as a result of this vow. This Midrash contends that when Yaakov fought an angel at Ma'avar Yabok, the angel had come to demand that Yaakov fulfill his promised tithe. Right? We have all sorts of explanations for what happened, this mysterious fight that they have in the middle of the night. This is one you may not have heard of before. That actually, it's, Yaakov, you haven't fulfilled the promise. You have gained so much while you were away with Laban, including a whole bunch of kids. After Yaakov calculated and designated 10% of his cattle, the angel challenged Yaakov, don't you also have 10 sons? You owe one to God. I don't know what to do with Dina, I'm sorry, but that's the way the calculation is made here. He has... is Binyamin born at the time when he... No, Binyamin's not born yet.
I was saying...
Oh, is he 11?
He has 11, not 10.
He has 11, not 10.
But he doesn't know that
Yosef.
He thinks Yosef is dead.
No, this is long before that. This is long before that.
This is when he's crossing. Back into Egypt.
Right.
No.
Right, no, that's not it. No. Yosef is still there.
Right.
Yosef is undoubtedly still there. Grounding. Or, you know what it would be? I'll tell you what it would be. It's like Maser Behema. Right? When you tithe your animals, so the rule is, you count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you tithe the tenth. And then, if there's a remainder, they don't need to be tithed. So that's what it would be. It's the tithe of his first ten. In which case, he has Dina also, but Dina also won't figure into this calculation. You have a remainder. But this Midrash then offers two ways in which Yaakov counted his sons to conclude that Levi was the tenth. Your problem is that Levi isn't number ten. So how does that work? Either Yaakov discounted the firstborns of different mothers, leaving him with eight. Right? He took out the firstborn from Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah. So he only has eight left. Then he counted through all of them, and when he finished, began again. Levi, being the second non-firstborn, came out as number ten. You follow? In other words, he takes out the firstborn because the firstborn are specifically rejected. God says they're not going to be the ones to serve me. So that they're not it. So then he starts with Shimon, works his way through the count, hits Shimon again, and then hits Levi. Okay. Alternatively, Yaakov began counting backwards from Binyamin, making Levi number 10. This Midrash does not mention that Binyamin was not yet born. That's making both calculations problematic. Binyamin's not born yet. How in the world did you do this? The answer is that what this Midrash is trying to do is not to give me a historical statement about how Levi ended up serving. Again, the Chumash is very clear that Levi is designated because of what happens at the Egel. That it's the firstborn until then, and then in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, we're told, you do a pidyon, you do a redemption, it's firstborn being exchanged. That's not what this Midrash is trying to say. What this Midrash is trying to say is that there's a notion of tithing the people as well. It isn't just that we tithe our property, but actually we tithe human beings. You know, think of Moshe Feinstein Tshuva. He has a classic question. He was asked by someone who was learning in yeshiva whether there is an obligation for him to go learn with somebody who was a weaker student and needed help. And Rabbi Feinstein's answer was, you have to tithe your time. Just like you tithe your money, you tithe your time. 10% of your time is a lot of time, by the way. People have to realize what that means. But you tithe your time and volunteer it to help others. That was his answer to the yeshiva student. There's more to that, but that's the more or less of it. As a matter of fact, by the way, there's a commentary to the Mishnah in Maasrot. The Mishnah in Maasrot, the very beginning, there's a commentary called Maaseh Rokeach, who adds the double language of Aser Aserenu, which is what Yaakov says, I will tithe, I will surely tithe, right? The double language is where we get the ceiling of 20%, because we're taught that you're supposed to separate 10% for tzedakah, but no more than 20%, unless, as some of the some halachic authorities write, the person is so superlatively rich that they can give more than 20%, and it won't affect them, fine. But generally speaking, you're not supposed to impoverish yourself, and so therefore you give up to 20%. So the Maaseh Rokeach says, Yaakov doesn't give one son, Yaakov gives two. Right? Yaakov gives Levi for the Beis HaMikdash, but he gives Yehuda for monarchy. So he actually ends up giving two. So one approach, and this is what Gita was suggesting, is that you're separating 10% as a religious act. You're tithing the nation just like we tithe other things. And it fits very nicely with what came right before it at the end of chapter 10. We talked about tithing the animals, and we talked about tithing the produce, and so now we're talking about tithing the people. That would be one approach. However, if you take a look at source number 16, the Zakat approach fits more with what Debbie said. He says, the notion of having one-tenth of the population in the national capital is certainly in line with modern population flows. So too is the phenomenon, especially in the developing world, I'm not sure why it's capitalized, of poorer people migrating, he did it, I didn't, of poorer people migrating in droves from the countryside to urban areas. The capitals of many major states today represent between 8 and 12% of the total national population. He doesn't say which major states this is. He usually likes to tell you when he has like a specific thing. He doesn't do it over here. I have no idea what major states he's talking about that have 10%. Did 10% of Canadians live in Ottawa? Pretty sure that's not true.
No, so,
yeah. But the capital.
But the move from rural to urban is more than
10%.
Not to mention they're not doing a move from rural to urban. It is in effect, but that's not why they're doing it. Right.
Paris, London.
Is that 10% of the country?
Tokyo, Cairo, those.
Are they 10% of the country? I have no idea whatsoever. I would like to assign homework. If someone wants this as an assignment for next week, they can go home and find out what percentage. Hey, that's what he says is going on. So he views this as a pragmatic move, a calculation, as opposed to a religious act. Okay, there's more to be said here. We have to go through the question of who exactly is volunteering. At this point, but yeah, I have to leave to go to a funeral, so we're going to have to pick up with this, God willing, next week. Thank you.